Iran says its comprehensive cooperation agreement with Venezuela is a turning point in their relations. Tensions flare up between the US and China over balloons, which Washington says Beijing has sent into American airspace for spying. And the European Union vows to support Ukraine in its war with Russia, but says Kiev's accession to the bloc will not be quick. Our top story, Tehran says a comprehensive cooperation agreement between Iran and Venezuela is a turning point in relations between the two countries. Iran's foreign minister, Hossein Amir Abdullahian, who is visiting Caracas, made the remarks during a meeting with Venezuelan President Nicolas Maduro. Amir Abdullahian said the implementation of bilateral deals with Caracas would boost ties further. Maduro, for his part, said the experience of the two countries in dealing with shared issues necessitates, that is, strengthening relations. The two sides also stressed the need to stand up against foreign pressure and defend their national interests. Amir Abdullahian earlier held talks with Venezuela's vice president, among other top officials, and discussed ways to strengthen ties in different fields. Five Palestinians have been injured in the Aghabat Jabr camp in the occupied West Bank, where Israeli forces have surrounded a Palestinian home. The regime soldiers have reportedly stormed the camp with heavy machinery. Our correspondent in Ramallah, Mona Kandil, joined us earlier with more details.
For the sixth consecutive day, Israeli forces had been imposing a curfew or a closure on the Aqbat Jabr refugee camp in Ariha because the Israelis claim that a Palestinian opened fire at an Israeli restaurant near illegal settlement built in Ariha. The Israelis claim that this Palestinian who opened fire is originally from Aqbat Jabr refugee camp. Every day, Israeli forces raid Aqbat Jabr and prevent Palestinians to move freely. But what's happening since the early hours of this morning is that Israeli forces raided Aqbat Jabr, surrounded a house there. They claim that the Palestinian who opened fire at a restaurant is from Aqbat Jabr, and they are ordering his father and brothers to hand their son to the Israeli forces. As we are receiving now, all the entrances of Ariha and the main roads leading to Ariha, not only Aqbat Jabr, are completely closed. Israeli forces are not allowing anyone to enter or to leave the area. Three Palestinians had been wounded during this operation. And it seems that the Israeli forces insist to arrest this Palestinian before leaving Aqbat Jabr and Ariha.
Now, the situation has also been tense in the West Bank city of Nablus, where Israeli forces killed a Palestinian. They claimed that the Palestinian man had attacked troops stationed at an outpost. That happened on Friday, the same day Israeli forces injured dozens of Palestinians protesting against illegal settlements in the West Bank. They targeted Palestinians with live bullets and tear gas. So far this year, Israeli forces have killed 36 Palestinians in the occupied territories. Turning elsewhere, China has accused U.S. media and politicians of using the recent balloon incident as pretext to launch a smear campaign against Beijing. The Chinese Foreign Ministry issued a statement after the U.S. Secretary of State cancelled a planned trip to the country over allegations that Beijing flew a spy balloon over the US. China had already expressed regret over the issue, blaming winds for pushing what it called a civilian airship into US airspace. On Saturday, China further said that it never violated the territory and airspace of any sovereign nation. The ministry also emphasized the need for maintaining communication channels at all levels to deal with some unexpected situations. Antony Blinken issued a personal note to his Chinese counterpart after the discovery of the balloon over the U.S. state of Montana.
In my call today with Director Wang Yi, I made clear that the presence of this surveillance balloon in U.S. airspace is a clear violation of U.S. sovereignty and international law, that it's an irresponsible act, and that the PRC's decision to take this action on the eve of my planned visit is detrimental to the substantive discussions that we were prepared to have.
Blinken further said that the U.S. remains committed to diplomatic engagement with China and that he would make a trip to Beijing once conditions are favorable. Meanwhile, the Pentagon said it has spotted a second similar balloon flying over Latin America. Beijing had already denied the U.S. accusation of spying. It said the balloon was used for meteorological purposes and had unintentionally escaped into U.S. airspace. Emmanuel Pastrich is the president at the Asia Institute and joins us now live from Tokyo. Emmanuel, it's like watching a comedy show with these American U.S. officials when it comes to the accusations about China violating U.S. territorial integrity with a weather balloon that drifted off course. I mean, China has satellites in space that can be used for surveillance if it wanted to spy on the U.S.
Right. Well, I think the ultimate goal here is to degrade the political discussion to the level of kindergarten. There's a lot of spying between the United States and China. Increasingly, it's not really about countries at all, but rather private intelligence firms that sell information of a very often dangerous nature to the highest bidder. So it doesn't really have anything to do with spying. I think the most important takeaway from this incident is that it is the Pentagon which is telling us whether it happened, you know, what really happened, we don't know, that's making the decision. And then the White House and the Department of State are then following up on what's already been decided by the Pentagon. This is exactly what we're seeing in the case of Ukraine as well, in which the backroom boys, the Pentagon, decide first what the United States is going to do, and then it's fed to the White House, National Security Council, and to the Secretary of State. And ultimately, it means that you're increasingly having a military running the country.
When we hear, Emmanuel, these U.S. accusations of China intruding or violating American territorial integrity, this is the same country that has violated the territorial integrity of just about every country in the world, is it not?
Including the United States, I would add. So essentially, we have a system which is out of control. And now, sadly, this relatively tiny group of people within the military and the arms contractors are making policy for the entire country, feeding it to the politicians, and they have really no brakes on them. They're going, in the case of Ukraine, basically any weapon, except for nuclear weapons so far, although that might come soon, is being fed. In the case of China, a country, I think as a whole, Chinese have a relatively positive view of the United States. Many Chinese have family in the United States. It was not a hostile relationship, but billions and billions of dollars are being poured into making it, hyping it up to be some sort of enemy. And Blinken's trip is totally logical. He should go very frequently, canceling it over this one minor matter out of, you know, thousands of similar ones, really shows us that the whole system is falling apart. The wheels are coming off of the cart.
Right. And then finally, Emmanuel, during the during the long course of this Chinese weather balloon, why didn't, which is, of course, difficult to steer, and which was used for perhaps espionage or surveillance maybe 70 or 80 years ago, why didn't the other countries lodge complaints with Beijing?
Right. Well, I don't really buy the story to start with. I think there's all sorts of information which is bought and sold between the United States and China and other countries, and that weather balloons are the least likely. So other countries didn't complain because other countries know that these weather balloons are insignificant in terms of the gathering of information. That's my guess. So basically, other countries have governments which are slightly more functional, right? They're not engaged in this sort of comedy of errors, this circus. I mean, this is what we had with the General Mininan's comments about war with China by 2025. I mean, it looked like people are chomping at the bit to start a war as soon as possible with a country which, as I just stated, is not hostile towards the United States. I find, in general, Chinese have a more positive impression of the United States than many other countries. So to go out of your way to sort of pick a fight, start a war, let alone starting a war with both China and Russia, which basically may be the end of humanity, but certainly would mean the end of the United States. I think it suggests a certain psychopathic mentality.
Thank you for your contribution. Emmanuel Pastrich is the president at the Asia Institute, joining us live from the Japanese capital of Tokyo. Philippines has allowed the U.S. to boost its military presence there by giving Washington access to four more bases in the country. The move is part of Washington's attempts to gain strategic advantage over China in the region. Washington and Manila are concerned about over Beijing's increasing assertiveness in the South China Sea, and China has slammed the U.S.'s increasing military presence in the region as a provocation.
The United States is ramping up its efforts to counter China's growing regional power. Amid Washington's rising tensions with Beijing over the South China Sea and Taiwan, Washington and Manila agreed on plans to accelerate the full implementation of the, quote, Enhanced Defense Cooperation Agreement, with the full agreement to designate four new agreed locations in strategic areas of the Philippines. The deal would allow Washington to deploy military equipment and rotate its troops to four more bases. Washington has currently five bases in the Philippines. The two sides also agreed on the substantial completion of the project in existing agreed locations.
Today, Secretary Galvez and I also reaffirmed our mutual defense treaty commitments. And we'd note that the mutual defense treaty applies to armed attacks on either of our armed forces, public vessels, or aircraft anywhere in the South China Sea or the West Philippine Sea.
According to experts, Washington's access to those bases could provide U.S. forces a strategic position from which to mount operations in the event of a conflict over Chinese Taipei or in the South China Sea. China has criticized the U.S. for its plan to increase its military presence in the Philippines, warning that granting the U.S. greater access to military bases by Manila could hurt regional stability and raise tensions. The move is part of U.S. plans to encircle China's maritime border in anticipation of a war over Taiwan, which Beijing considers as its own. Last year, tensions rose to unprecedented levels after the then U.S. House Speaker Nancy Pelosi visited the island. China has repeatedly warned against any attempt that delegitimizes its national sovereignty. Furthermore, China claims sovereignty over virtually all of the South China Sea, which is also claimed in part by Brunei, Vietnam, Malaysia, and the Philippines. The waters are believed to sit atop vast reserves of oil and gas.
Moving on, the EU Commission chief says there is no rigid timeline for Kiev's accession to the European Union.
there are no rigid timelines, but there are goals that you have to reach. Reforms, for example, to improve a situation in the candidate country to then reach the accession negotiations and the accession itself. It's impressive.
You're taking... Von der Leyen praised Kiev's determination to meet EU recommendations despite being at war with Russia. Elsewhere in her remarks, the EU Commission chief said a new package of sanctions against Moscow is on its way to make Russia pay for its actions in Ukraine. She said technology will be targeted in the fresh sanctions to curb Russia's ability to produce drones. Meanwhile, Ukraine's President Volodymyr Zelensky urged the EU to accelerate its arms supply to Kiev.
If weapons are accelerated, namely long-range weapons, we will not only not withdraw from Bakhmut, we will begin to deoccupy Donbas, which has been occupied since 2014.
Zelensky also said Kiev will not surrender Bakhmut and will fight as long as it can. This comes as Kiev's Western allies pledge more weapons, mainly sophisticated and long-range arms, to Ukraine. Russia has repeatedly warned the West's military support for Ukraine will only prolong the war and increase the suffering of its people. This as Russia ramps up pressure on Ukrainian forces in eastern battlegrounds and also in the northeast and south. To Chile now, where raging wildfires have killed at least 13 people as a summer heatwave sweeps across the southern hemisphere. At least one firefighter was among the fatalities. A pilot and a mechanic were also killed when their emergency support helicopter crashed. The blazes have damaged hundreds of homes and torched some 14,000 hectares across southern and central parts of the country. The government has declared states of catastrophe in the hardest hit regions, allowing for the deployment of soldiers and additional resources. The Chilean president has cut his vacation short to visit the affected areas. The interior minister has warned of risky conditions in the coming days as high temperatures and strong winds persist. That brings an end to the World Bulletin for this hour.
You have just listened to the Voice of the Islamic Republic of Iran broadcasting. The Voice of the Islamic Republic of Iran is broadcast daily round the clock for listeners across the globe. The Voice of the Islamic Republic of Iran can be heard via the internet, shortwave, FM, and satellite. Our listeners in the Indian subcontinent can listen to the Voice of the Islamic Republic of Iran via shortwave 31 meters, 9,650 kilohertz, every day from 1520 to 1620 UTC. Also, our listeners in Europe can tune in to the English service of the Voice of the Islamic Republic of Iran via shortwave 49 meters, 6,040 kilohertz, and in Southern Africa via shortwave 25 meters, 11,880 kilohertz every day from 1920 to 2020 UTC. Our listeners in Tehran can also listen to our programs via FM 91.5 megahertz. You can also listen to the Voice of the Islamic Republic of Iran on Hotbird, Eutelsat 3B, and Iran Sadorbat 5, and via the internet. Our internet address is parstoday.com/en. And now you can listen to IRIB English Radio via your mobile phone. Please refer to our website for the details. Please send your correspondence to the English program, PO Box number 19395-6767, Tehran, Islamic Republic of Iran, or email us to englishradio@irib.ir. We would be very pleased to have your comments about audio quality and other means. Thank you.
Islamic Revolution and Economic Achievements. In the name of God, salam and welcome to the program. Dear listeners, these days mark the 44th anniversary of the victory of the Islamic Revolution in Iran. In order to have a proper picture of the economic achievements of the Islamic Revolution, we should have a look at the waning days of the Pahlavi rule in Iran. During the Shah regime, Iran's economy was excessively dependent on oil exports. Millions of oil barrels were exported every day, while a huge amount of consumer goods worth hundreds of millions of dollars were imported to the country. During the last decade of the Shah reign, oil price enjoyed an unprecedented rise so that in 1977, the oil revenues reached over 20 billion of dollars, whereas this number never amounted to $1 billion in the decade before. American writer Francis Fitzgerald wrote that the Shah did not make serious effort for the development of the country. The country's wealth had been funneled mostly toward personal cars rather than buses, consumer goods rather than public health, and the salaries of soldiers and police rather than teachers. It can be said on the economy of 1970s in Iran that the regime's programs destroyed the economic balance of the country due to being far from the realities of society. As the Iranian economy was highly dependent on oil, the 1976 to 78 reduction of oil prices caused the government to borrow money, which in turn resulted in a bunch of problems, such as the shortage of skillful manpower, shortage of communicative networks like roads and ports, shortage of electricity, escape of capitals from the country, inflation, unemployment, housing, and so on. Unjust distribution of income in rural and urban regions and different strata of people caused remarkable class gap in society. Andrew Duncan, author of the book Looting Iran, Assault Towards Money, says that Iran's economy highly suffered from the ambitious and unwise plans of the Shah and his lack of information in the Iranian society. He writes that the Shah thought that money can solve every problem. He summoned the members of his cabinet on one day in August 1974 and announced that he wanted to double the 1973-78 development program. It meant to increase it from $35.5 billion to $86.8 billion. Although there were few specialists to implement such a huge plan, it would make no difference for the Shah. He would announce, for instance, that all children should go to school while forgetting that it needed at least 30,000 teachers. The Shah Prime Minister Hoveyda said in response to this great shortage, "No problem, we will teach all via TV." He had forgotten that over 65,000 villagers had no power grid at all. The victory of Iran's Islamic Revolution in February 1979 revived hopes in the hearts of people. In spite of unprecedented pressures of enemies to obstruct or at least slow down the move of the revolution towards lofty ideals, including the 8-year imposed war, innumerable conspiracies inside and outside the country, and also imposition of the cruelest illegal sanctions on every aspect of the country's economy, The Islamic Republic has marched proudly in the course of growth and development. Justice enjoys a very outstanding position in Islam. According to the Quran, the aim of mission of all prophets has been to establish justice in society. Imam Ali, peace upon him, says that cities and countries will not be developed except by justice. In view of this, among the most important goals of the officials in three branches of governance has been to provide welfare for people and provide them justice in various economic fields. Before the revolution, few villages enjoyed electricity, hygiene, water, natural gas, and telephone. This was common, even among small cities and towns. Less than 12% of the rural areas had access to water grid, while this figure has surpassed 82%. There was 0 kilometer of water transferring line before the revolution, whereas the figure has reached almost 31 kilometers after the revolution. Qadir project in Khuzestan province has recently been exploited. The project is said to be the greatest in West Asia, and it will transfer drinking water to 26 cities and over 1,600 villages. The project has been implemented by Khatam al-Anbiya Construction Base, whose young experts have managed to finish the project within 8 months, while it was predicted to end in 36 months. The Islamic Republic of Iran has been successful in the field of dam construction. The number of dams in the country has increased tenfold compared with the pre-revolution era. In other words, nearly 200 dams have been built in Iran by a skillful young specialist. Dams are useful in various domains, including the production of hydroelectric energy. Iran is among the 10 top nations in the construction of power plants. This has caused 100% of the population in the cities and approximately 99.6% of the rural people to enjoy electricity. This, while the average electricity access among villages and cities in the world is 79 and 96% respectively. Another success in Iran in the field of energy is the construction of petrochemical factories and refineries. Over 70% of Iran's energy consumption relies on natural gas. Currently, more than 98% of cities and 84% of villages are connected to the natural gas grid. There are nearly 2,000 active oil companies in the country. Before the revolution, the major part of this industry was run by foreign firms, but today Iranian experts have succeeded to indigenize 80% of the equipment needed in the field. The great bulk of this equipment is high-tech. 50 of the manufacturing companies are in the international rank and export some of their products, like catalysts, to Russia. Iran seriously tries to increase the number of petrochemical factories and refineries to prevent crude sale. Today, the number of active petrochemical complexes has increased to 68, more than tenfold the period before the revolution. Between 90 to 100 million liters of gasoline is averagely produced every day in the country. This includes 27% of Iran's refinery basket, which is higher than the global average.
Bring us now from Ontario, Canada.
Now back to our story.
What is it in there?
We will be talking about this.
Let me bring in Leo Sazdi. He's a professor of international.
the spotlight.
Welcome to Spotlight. The Israeli regime has recently stepped up its crackdown against Palestinians in every way possible. It has been raiding towns, demolishing homes, and murdering people at an increasingly alarming rate. Despite all these crimes, the international community remains silent as Tel Aviv expands its illegal settlements. Certain Arab countries, most recently Sudan, are establishing relations with the Israeli regime, a move that Palestinians say betrays their cause and emboldens the occupiers to continue with their crimes. We're going to discuss that with our guests tonight in our Spotlight program. Joining us, we have Professor of Political Science at Bir Zeid University, Saad Nim, who's joining us from Ramallah. Also, we have human rights activist Mohsen Naghvi, who's joining us from Houston, Texas. Well, gentlemen, welcome to the program. Let's start off with Professor Nim in Ramallah. Well, defying international calls and outcry, Israel has approved plans to build about 1,200 more settler units in occupied Al-Quds. Under international law, we know that all Israeli settlements are illegal, and the Israeli judicial system has no legal authority over the population that it occupies. Human Rights Watch has time and again said these policies amount to apartheid and crimes against humanity. Why are these policies continuing then?
Well, this is the policy of this regime, this colonial regime. This is their policy. The whole idea for the Israelis is to ethnically cleanse Palestine, and particularly to starting with to ethnically cleanse Jerusalem. You know that we have more than 22,000 houses already served with orders to be demolished in Jerusalem. And at the same time, they are building more and more settlements. The whole idea came up after the year 2000, when they started this plan called 2020, in 20 years from 2020 to reduce the number of Palestinians who were at that time around 40% of the population in Jerusalem, East Jerusalem, to bring them down to 12%. Accordingly, they have to demolish houses, take the citizenship from the Palestinians, cleansing them out, and not giving any permits to build houses, and at the same time, annexing more settlements and building more settlements and enlarging existing settlements by adding new units. Now, we are talking about around 800,000 settlers in the West Bank, including Jerusalem. The new plan now in 2025 to make the settlers to reach 1 million settlers in the West Bank and Jerusalem. Accordingly, they are building more and more in the settlement, in spite of the international law, which stated clearly that this is against the international law and against Geneva Convention, and at the same time against also human rights, because they are, moving the Palestinian out and bringing in more settlements and settlers. I'll give you one example. For instance, in the Jabal Abu Ghneim, or as they call it, Har Huma, a settlement there, the capacity for building for the settlers is 120% per land. Meaning that they are going into high even buildings, while in the same area near to Jabal Abu Ghneim, the Palestinian area, the building their capacity, they are giving the Palestinian only 40%. So if you have a land only on 40% of it, you can build. But in the settlements, they built 120%. So it's quite clear that they are trying to cleanse the Palestinians out and increase the number of the settlers in Jerusalem.
Mohsen Naghvi, what are the Israelis achieving with this land grab policy, apart from their efforts of Judaization of Palestinian land. Are the Israelis also deliberately sabotaging any prospects of future Palestinian statehood?
Certainly, there's absolutely no doubt that this is the wish of the Israeli, the Zionist regime, that they believe and they think, and I think it's the strategy has failed, and it is not a viable strategy for them to make more colonies and make more settlements, because if they believe and feel that by bringing in more settlers and by expanding their colony, if that will solidify their position in the West Bank or the Al-Quds or Jerusalem area, they are absolutely mistaken. This is a mistake. This is a strategic mistake that they are making. And the reason why I say that this is a strategic mistake is because their very existence on that land is absolutely unnatural. They have nothing to do with that land. They have absolutely no affiliation with that land whatsoever. And so their very existence on that land is unnatural. By bringing in Jews from Europe, by bringing in Jews from different parts of the world, from the U.S., for instance, and settling them in Palestine, will not in any way ensure their existence on that land. That's one thing. Secondly, with these expansions and with these colonies, these so-called colonies that they're creating, they're giving the world one message. And the message is that the resistance has been right from the get-go. Israel never wanted a two-state solution. The Zionist regime is telling the world that they do not want a viable solution to Palestine, that they do not respect international law, that they do not respect the Geneva Convention. They don't respect any kind of compromise or law. And this is exactly why the resistance movements have been screaming out loud to the entire world that a two-state solution is not viable, it is unfair, and it can never happen, because the Zionist regime doesn't want a two-state solution. The Zionist regime wants to keep expanding its colonies. It wants to create more colonies and bring in more settlers from different parts of the world. But it is not working. It is clearly not working. Very soon, within the next 10, 15 years, we'll see that these same settlers who they're making colonies for will be going back to where they came from, because they will not be able to withstand the pressure that the resistance forces will unleash on them. They're already failing right now. The Zionist regime is on the verge of becoming a failed state.
All right, Professor Nim, on Thursday, Israel and Sudan said they'd finalized a deal to normalize relations during a visit by the Israeli foreign minister to Khartoum. Give us your views on this move by Sudan. Palestinians have repeatedly slammed these normalization deals between Arab states and the Israeli regime as a stab in the back. In your opinion, have these Arab governments turned a blind eye to the suffering of the Palestinian people?
Well, we are discussing here two issues, or two separate kinds of normalization. The one kind, which, like, you know, Emirates and Morocco and Bahrain did, and they are not under such a pressure. The pressure, only the American pressure, which is a normal pressure in this case, and they are willing to go, you know, ahead with this normalization with Israel. But in the case of Sudan, which is a little bit different, Sudan, you know, even before the revolution that happened a few years ago or 2 years ago, it was marked by the Americans as a terrorist regime. And in order to get out of this marking as a terrorist regime, apparently the deal was you have to normalize relationship with Israel. Otherwise, yani, why? We can't even imagine why the Sudanese will do such a thing. But the military government there, they were under such a pressure by the Americans, and they apparently complied with this pressure to normalize relationship with Israel. Now, the foreign minister of Israel being visiting Khartoum, the capital of Sudan, and having this kind of, you know, normal relation in order to sign the agreement, what would the Sudanese get out of this, you know, deal? or nor even the Israeli. From the Israeli point of view, it's, you know, they are trying to set the fact that normalization with all the Arab countries first before they even think about talking to the Palestinians. And once they have normal relationship with all the Arabs, then forget about the Palestinians. From our side, as Palestinians, we think that all these kind of normalization and agreements under the pretension or under the name of Abraham Accords are absolutely stabbing in the back of the Palestinians, and these Arabs are letting go of the Palestinian cause, and they are not committed at all to any kind of relationship with the Palestinian in such case, because they are, you know, going ahead directly to have this kind of peace relationship with our enemy in the region. And it's quite clear that the American pressure started since the Trump administration, and now it's continuing. Netanyahu's new government, after he was elected just a few weeks ago, he said, I'm not going to talk about the Palestinian question. I'm not going even to discuss the Palestinian question, but rather we are going to focus on more Arab countries to normalize the relationship with Israel. And he said that we are very close of some of Gulf states, countries that they will join the accord, Abraham Accord, and we will focus on that matter. So it's quite clear that he's saying that he's not going to look at the Palestinian question, while his government, especially with this Smotrich and Ben-Gvir and this fascist government now in Israel, are going ahead with a full steam atrocities against the Palestinians. Ben-Gvir now started with the prisons, now the prisons in a form of a kind of a revolution, and we are expecting now a huge kind and a big hunger strike in all the prisons. He's attacking the villages and grabbing more land, settlements, enlarging settlements. And he was the one behind the El Khan El Ahmar in sure. Jericho area, yes, in order to demolish it, but now they postpone it till June. They are doing all the things. And Smotrich, he confiscated the Palestinian money, and okay. They are going ahead. And Netanyahu is not concerned with all that at all.
This is The Spotlight. The Spotlight takes an in-depth look at the headlines, featuring interviews with well-known guests from diverse backgrounds to get to the bottom of the story. You can listen to The Spotlight every day on IRIB English Radio.
Mohsen Avi, Hamas has strongly condemned Sudan for finalizing this deal, saying the normalization would in fact embolden Israel to continue its racist crimes against Palestinians. Are these normalization deals in a way a green light for the Israelis to continue their day-to-day crimes and brutal killings of Palestinians?
You see, I think there are two aspects to this question. The first aspect is that it is not the people of Sudan. It is not the people of the Arab world. It is the governments of these countries
sure.
that are promoting these normalization efforts. And also, they've been trying to test their people for so long now. They've been trying to take a feel of what if Arab Muslim society or Sudanese society, how will they react to these normalization efforts? And this has been going on since the past 10, 15 years. And I can tell you for a fact that the very reason why the arrogant powers of the world selectively place governments that are either monarchies or dictatorships is so that they can easily control them. It is very tough to control a democratic government that has been chosen by the people, because trust me, the will of the people, the kind of attachment that the people, that the Muslims of the world have with Al-Quds, it is not that simple to have these normalization efforts succeed. If anything, these dictatorships, these monarchies are threatened from within their people, that if these normalization efforts are successful and they do, there's a huge chance that there'll be coup, that there will be a coup within within these nations. Now, when Hamas criticizes these countries, they're obviously criticizing the governments. The governments are clearly making a mistake, and the reason why they're making these mistakes is because the US, the arrogant powers of the world, have confined them within within debts. They've confined them militarily. They are in debt to the World Bank, and the way they operate is that we'll compromise and get rid of a certain loan only if you normalize efforts with Israel. That's how they function. But it's very tough for them to pull this off. I'll give you the example of Pakistan. As soon as the people of Pakistan smelled that the new government of Imran Khan or the establishment of Pakistan is tilting towards normalizing relationships with Israel, there were protests all over Pakistan. I'm originally from Pakistan, so I can say this for a fact. There were protests all over Pakistan. There were riots all over Pakistan. So the sentiment that the Muslims have towards Palestine is more than just an ethnical or a nationalistic inclination. It's a very religious inclination that we have towards Al-Quds, towards Masjid Al-Aqsa. So it won't be as easy as they're making it sound. Yeah, this is obviously one of their dreams, that, and this is one of their efforts, that efforts are normalized. Because then they think if efforts are normalized, then within the Arab world, the resistance movement will not be able to spread as it is spreading right now. But with the success of Hezbollah, with the success of Hamas, with the success of Islamic Jihad, there are other factions in Bahrain, there are factions within Saudi Arabia who are also taking inspiration and influence from these successes. And I think it is practically impossible for these normalization efforts to succeed because of those reasons.
Sure. Professor Nimr, as we've seen in the past, there's been a lot of opposition from the people of these countries, as Mohsen Aghvi just alluded to as well. They disapprove of these deals. They aren't happy at all with them. So what are these governments gaining in return for these normalization deals? And basically, is it worth it, taking into consideration that these deals might one day backfire?
Well, yes, I think so, and I do agree with your guest who said that the pressure coming from America and the money pressure and from the World Bank and other issues that the Americans have against this dictatorship. But for the people, it's definitely another story. In Morocco, there were many demonstrations in Morocco against the normalization, and in Morocco we have a very strong kind of a BDS movement and a support to the Palestinians among the people themselves, and we saw that also clearly in the World Cup. Also in Bahrain, there were demonstrations and people were against this normalization, and they clearly make the statement that they are not going for, to approve this kind of normalization apart from the regime itself. So definitely we are talking about regimes from one hand and people on the other hand. Now, if you come to Emirates, first of all, there is no people. We are talking about a government with only 17% of the population. And I'm quite sure that if we ask these people in Emirates also, they are against this normalization. People will get nothing out of this normalization. Governments, they make their position with America much better, and they think that the only way to win the heart of the Americans is by normalizing with Israel. So they think that that will be the benefit for them, to give them access to more money from the World Bank, or to get them out of this list of blacklist, or American blacklist, or any other kind of. And this is only for the dictatorships in themselves and for the regimes, not for the people. And we believe that, sooner or later, the people will say their world, and they will go against their governments in such cases. Even when we talk about in Jordan or even in Egypt, who had, you know, like for many years, the normalization with Israel, there is no real normalization. You know, after more than or around for, more than 30 years of peace process between Egypt and or even 40 years between Egypt and Israel, the Egyptian people themselves are still against Israel, and they resent, as Israel expected, you know, a big kind of tourism coming to Israel from Egypt, or they will accept Israelis in Egypt normally. No, it's still the relationship still among the people themselves is really different. It's only between the dictatorship and the regime and the Israelis. And we believe that sooner or later people will say their word and they will go against these regimes, and they will pay the price for what they to the Palestinians.
Right. Mohsen Naqvi, what about the United States here and Israel? In many accounts, do you believe that they're trying to legitimize the occupation? If Arab governments are normalizing ties with Israel and they aren't prioritizing the Palestinian cause for the region, then it's easier to get other countries to downplay it as well. Is that what's being done here, in your opinion?
Well, that's what they're trying to do. The relationship between U.S. and Israel, it's a close relationship, but it's also a very sensitive relationship. And the reason why I say that is that Zionists control so much of the United States. May that be the weapons industry, may that be the media industry, this may that be the property industry. There's so much that the Zionists control within the U.S. that it's almost as if the Israelis, the Zionist regime, or their representatives, they run the U.S. The lobbyists that we see that work and who work on behalf of the Zionist regime within the U.S. are so strong. I mean, we all know about Jeffrey Epstein and the kind of influence and the kind of pull he had on these government officials. May that be Elon Musk, Bill Gates. Name any billionaire within the U.S., because as we all know, that the U.S. establishment are its billionaires. The U.S. establishment are its company. This is the military empire that controls the U.S. in general. And unfortunately, the Zionist regime has a huge grip, a very strong grip on U.S. politics because of the kind of pull they have financially. Now, as far as the people of the United States is concerned, especially the people who support the Republican Party, who have a slightly religious inclination, they do wonder and they do think that we talk about free medical within the U.S. We don't have money for medical care. We don't have money for free education, but we have money. The billions of dollars that are paid towards the Zionist regime, the American people are now wondering for what reason, for what influence, as the U.S. empire is becoming weaker and weaker in the Middle East, and as the U.S. empire is moving more towards electricity and is moving towards oil, their interest within the subcontinent, within the Middle East, is slowly decreasing. And their use for the Zionist regime is also decreasing with that. So there's this huge disparity within the U.S. establishment right now. And as we can all see, that there are government officials as of now who are giving statements against the actions of Ben-Gavir, who are giving statements against the actions of the new far-right Netanyahu government. There's a reason for that. We haven't seen the U.S. government be critical of the Zionist regime. I mean, the parties, the opposition within Israel is also supported and funded by the U.S. and the U.K. So we've never seen this before in the past. That there are voices within Israel right now who are speaking out against the current government. So there is this huge disparity that we see. There's this huge difference. And I believe that as soon as the U.S. realizes that the Zionist regime was a mistake, and as soon as the U.S. pulls out its influence and its support to the Zionist regime will crumble and fall.
All right, thanks a lot, gentlemen. That's all the time we have for tonight's program. Allow me to thank my guests, Professor Saad Nimr, joining us from Ramallah, and also thanks to human rights activist Mohsen Naqvi, joining us from Houston, Texas. And a special thanks to you for staying with us on tonight's Spotlight. It's good night for now, and see you next time. We'll be right back.
congratulations to everyone on the occasion of 13th of Rajab, the birthday anniversary of the Commander of the Faithful and the leader of the pious, Imam Ali ibn Abi Talib, peace be upon him. Here in the Islamic Republic of Iran, it is also Father's Day. We congratulate all Muslims on this auspicious occasion.
Tawakkul comes from the root word wakala. Wakala means...
Today, I'd like to read to you an excerpt from...
Allah is the unique Arabic name.
Allah subhanahu wa ta'ala has decree.
His decree, though...
Ya Allah, كل شيء ومليك يا رب.
This is Foresight, a program on how to worship Allah.
يا خالق كل شيء ووارث.
Today's great tip: don't rely simply on your age when it comes to increasing, strengthening, and powering up our ubudiyah, our servitude to Allah. So, dear listeners, we are humbly speaking about how age can be detrimental to our ubudiyah. Now, when we're talking about age, we're talking about an advancement in age. So, meaning we're talking about for example, a 15-year-old versus a 24-year-old versus a 40-year-old versus a 55-plus-year-old individual. Now, this increasing of age can be detrimental. Of course, if the different kind of moral and ethical virtues, and on the other side, the negative behaviors and actions, if both of these are not controlled, then with the advancement of age, we find that they are detrimental to our ubudiyah, our service, our obedience, our servitude to the Almighty Allah. And so you might ask, how? How is it possible that... Well, so let's take this into two different aspects. One is the aspect of the akhlaqi, moral and ethical virtues. And of course, the other are these negative habits or these bad habits that we have. Now, when it comes to our moral and ethical values, of course, things like sincerity, speaking the truth, helping others, paying charity. These are certain aspects of moral and ethical virtues, or as it is known in the Arabic and in the Persian, they are akhlaqi virtues, as well as benevolence and charity and generosity.